top performing companies have, you know, they're successful, but top performing companies are investing in the design. So as an architect or a designer, isn't me beating my breast saying, you got to do good design so I win some design awards. No, good design will increase your bottom line. It will help with hiring people. It will help with retaining people. And it will help with building the business. People get attracted to, you know, a culture that is, you know, that embraces design innovation and uses it to their advantage.
You are listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
So on today's episode of Hooked on Startups, I'm absolutely delighted to have Ken Baker. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Matthew.
So let me see if I can do some justice, Ken. So you're the a member of Gensler's Board of Directors and the Gensler Management Committee. You're the co-managing principal of their Southeast region.
But
let me just say a tiny bit about who Gensler is, because you are the largest global architecture, design and planning firm with more than 5,000 professionals across Asia, Europe, Australia, Middle East, the Americas, 44 locations. Is it 30 practice areas now?
I think it's 29.
So it's a fantastically successful company with revenues of over $1 billion a year. So how do you manage to stay under the radar so much?
Well, first of all, there's a couple of answers to that question, a number of answers, actually. I think we've attained our position because we really focus on a culture of innovation. Our culture is that of innovation, and I think that strikes a note with our clients. Another reason is that we have those 29 practice areas, and we're able to build as the economy shifts and it goes down in one area, another area is growing, and so I think that second answer is diversification. And we hire great people. We hire the best, and we treat them very well. And we, you know, our intellectual property is our thought leadership and our folks, and we give them a career path to succeed and allow them, you know, we allow them to fail, but we also expect them to grow.
And how do you manage 5,000 people? How do you create that sort of culture across all of your divisions, all of the countries that you operate in? Because as we know, a company is only as strong as its weakest link. So across all those different international cultures, how do you create that culture of success?
Matthew, that's a bit of a complicated answer, but I'll try to simplify it. We have broken the firm. Well, first of all, we have the 44 offices in 10 regions of the world. We have all of those practice areas, but we have people that are on point for leading. We've got co-leaders in each office, in each region. We have a very strong board of directors that communicates, and we are what we call a one-firm firm. There is a conference call that we have every Monday morning starting in the East Coast at 11 o'clock, and it goes to about 1:30 on a good day, and we go through every office, starting with Asia. Every office talks on that call and presents on a video call their new business leads and their new opportunities. So there's very much of a lot of communication. To add to that, we also have broken, looking at the firm, at the very basic building blocks, all of our offices are made up of studios. So a studio would have 30 to 40 people, say. So while you're 5,500 person firm, when you're a client, your project lives in a studio, in an office somewhere. So you're dealing with a small business within a larger business. And we make sure that those studio leaders are empowered. Studios are the building blocks. I like to think studios and practice areas are the building blocks of our success. The other thing that we've done is we've created four axes of the firm. We have the axes are like centers of things that we deal with. So just the way we manage the firm. So one axis is offices and all the issues that offices have, the 44 offices. One is client relationships. One is, that's a big tranche of folks that are really focused on how we're dealing with our clients. And we have practice areas. And that's that 29 practice area group. And then we have design synergy. And design synergy is four or five groups. It's like the project managers is one synergy. We call that design management. One are the designers. We call that design experience. We've got design realization. Those are the technical people. We have purpose and realization, or purpose and resilience as well. So there's five kind of areas that we focus on. And then lastly, because we have those 29 practice areas, they kind of get lumped into three buckets. Live, work, play, we call it. So if you look at all those practice areas, they fall into live or work or play, or we call it workplace, community, and lifestyle. And I know that's a bit of a complicated slicing and dicing the 44 offices, the 29 practice areas, and the 5,500 people. If you look at all those aspects of what I just described, that's how we manage the firm. And we have excellent CEOs who are have longevity, and we allow people to become leaders. We have 500 leadership positions in this firm.
But architecture is about glass and steel. It's not about people. Or am I?
We look at ourselves as a constellation of stars. The firm is not a starchitect kind of mentality. Our culture is about our teams. And it goes back to those teams live in those studios. Teams of experts deliver design innovation to our clients. It's not about one person. It's not about Ken Baker or even one of the CEOs. It is about the teams of folks that deliver great work to the client. Our clients are buying a team, are investing in a team, not in specific individuals. There are individuals that manage relationships, but they're bringing a team with them. And it's the culture is about we, not I.
And do you think that, I mean, you've been at Gensler for 23 years,
right?
How do you see this has changed? Because the traditional view of an architectural firm is cold drawings, reactive, tell us what you want and we'll build it. How has that changed over the years?
Our genesis, Matthew, came from, we were started as an interior design firm run by architects. Art Gensler, of course, a registered architect, but he looked at that what was being done in the business community for workplace was a tremendous opportunity. And he and his wife, Drew, started the firm in San Francisco 50 plus years ago, based on focus on interiors. So we kind of, and we call that going from the inside out. And then, of course, we added an architecture. So when we do architecture, we're looking at the inside in. So a lot of firms, and I worked at a couple of them, I started at Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. A lot of firms will be looking at the statement that the building makes, the shell and core of the building, and that's driving everything. We're looking at the users that live inside those buildings and making sure that, yes, there is a statement that's made by the architecture, by the shell of that building, but it's got to work for the users. It's got to work for the tenants in the building to be successful. So our approach has been both of those.
And again, is that sort of that move away from the shell and core approach, which is a very sort of 70s, 80s approach, was that driven by the market, or was that driven really just by the people within Gensler? Because it seems to me that Gensler is leading the way in this sort of approach, which is why you're very much top of the tree. And did you find that your sort of artistic musical background really lent itself to the understanding of, you know, what makes people tick when they're at work, as opposed to just the, you know, the glass and the steel?
That's a great analogy. Yes, I have been very much involved in the fine arts and, you know, art itself, like, you know, the drawing arts, and I play the piano and I performed on stage. And I think at one point in my life, I struggled with, I always wanted to be an architect, but I felt, you know, actually the university that I studied at, all of those groups were in the same college, the College of Fine and Applied Arts. So I always wanted to be an architect, but I could participate in all of those and aspects of playing the piano and performing on stage and drawing and creating art informed my career as an architect. And I think it also helped me relate to clients. And I think clients are, you know, it all begins and ends with our clients. And I think clients want to work with individuals who are multifaceted and yes, more creative and are bringing more to the table than just, you know, I do law firms and that's what I do. But they want to see that these folks, that the people that are working on their projects are actually coming from a diverse background, and they're bringing life experience into the workplace, into the design of innovative workplace.
And do you think that's driven primarily from the interior design aspect? So the interior design, which is the living, the breathing, the heart, the soul of the business. And was there a moment like an inflection or a watershed moment where suddenly you realized that this was a key differentiator that you had compared to other businesses?
Well, I'll answer from my own personal experience, Matthew. I worked, when I graduated from university, you know, wanting to be an architect meant wanting to do shell and core work, wanting to design structures. And so I went to work at Skidmore in Chicago, 1,200 people. And I was in a studio that was designing high-rise office buildings all over the world. In the 4 years or so that I was with Skidmore, the first 2 years was heads down learning my craft on how buildings went together. I mean, they teach you one thing in school, but then you actually have to get out of school and do it. And you've got to do it on a schedule and on a budget. But what I'm driving the point towards is I looked at, you know, I wasn't disillusioned with being a shell and core architect, but I looked at what my career would be in 40 years, and I saw in the first 4 years or the first 2 years working on shell and core, I was working on maybe two or three buildings at various times, but those are long-lived projects. To put up a high-rise office building takes many years. So if you just do the math, you know, you're going to have a handful of great projects that are, you know, major skyline statements. But if I worked in interiors, which is something that my kind of fine arts background, I think, drug pushed me into, I was finding that I was going to affect more people's lives, I felt, on an intimate basis by designing interiors, and B, on the selfish side of my own career, I was going to be able to lead a lot of projects. I was going to be able to work with a diverse set of projects versus the, you know, dozen or 15 buildings that you could do in a career. I was going to work on hundreds of client opportunities. And it intrigued me to look at architecture, interior architecture versus exterior architecture.
And do you remember your first client meeting?
I do. I never went, oddly, and this is what happens. I never went to a client meeting on shell and core. I was a junior level entry architect. I was there doing the drawings. Somebody else would take the drawings and walk down the hall into the meeting and present them. Immediately when I started working on interior architecture, it was a different world, even at that same firm. I was going and meeting with clients. And yes, I do remember I was working on the headquarters for the Boston Globe newspaper in Boston. And I'm still very proud of that project. With one of the first interiors projects I worked on, I still have those photos in my portfolio and I still think they're beautiful. And that was in 1982, 83 kind of.
And that meeting, did you find that you were slightly on edge when you were going into those meetings because you were thinking, this is the prescribed way that I should be doing things, but my heart and soul is saying I should be doing it a different way?
I'm not sure if I'm going to answer your question directly, but I think I know what you're driving at. I listened a lot. I mean, I wanted to be in that client meeting. I wanted to be in that presentation, but it would have been arrogant and a bit pompous to walk in and just talk. I absorbed a lot and contributed when I was asked to contribute. And I did a lot of listening. I did a lot of, and I think the listening part of it is something that I've come back to. I mentor young folks and well, folks of all ages. And I think listening to what our clients and our teams are saying is really, really important. The other thing I learned is that clients have budgets and schedules. And we've got that budget and that schedule, and those are bottom lines. We've got to adhere to their budget and their schedule. And if we're going to color outside of those lines, we have to be able to prove that what we're bringing to the table is value add to what they're, you know, what their goals and objectives are, and let them make that decision in advance.
Because I think that just look sort of fast forwarding to where you are, because I mean, how many people were at Gensler 20 something years ago?
Oh my God. So our region, I'll put it in perspective. Well, our New York office is, I think probably what, 600 people. And that was the size of the firm when I joined it. And now we're 5,500.
And that's 10. So that's a 10 times growth.
I have 700. I've got one of the big regions. My partner and I, my business partner and I run this region. We have 8 offices and we have about 750 people in 8 offices. And that was about the size of the, you know, that was kind of the size of the firm when I started in 1996 is when I was recruited.
And I think, do you think that the difference then, so that growth, that the point where you realize that you can actually grow this business compared to all your competition, was it the point where you're saying, well, we need to provide more than just react to what our customers or clients think they
need? Our clients were taking us to different locations. Two things. Our clients were asking us, we started in San Francisco, but San Francisco clients took us to Houston. San Francisco clients took us to Denver. San Francisco client, you know, Houston clients took us to New York. New York clients took us to London. So we go where our clients, we started the Chicago office because of a relationship that we started working with McDonald's in Chicago. That's how the Chicago office. When I started with Gensler in 96, I lived in Chicago. I had been there for 16 years. I was a design director at another firm. We did not have an office of Gensler then. I started that year. I was recruited by DC. I went to the DC office, and then I was traveling back to give my client relationships, which ended up helping, in addition to the McDonald's work, helping starting an office in Chicago.
And the growth of Gensler, so this cultural, was that the feeling that you had that we, in order to grow, we need to build this culture, we need to build on this ability to listen, to be creative. So where are all of these words that no one, were these used in hushed tones, creativity, design, in at that time?
I'll criticize my own profession a bit. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you, but I think that's a great point. And again, this is a personal viewpoint. I think architects and designers get dinged and criticized because it's about them a lot, and it should be about the clients. And I think our philosophy at Gensler is about servicing our clients and showing them that design innovation can affect their bottom line. But it's not about creating a star statement and fitting that square peg into the round hole for that client. Yeah, give them an award-winning building, but it's got to work and it's got to be successful. It's got to help build their culture. It's got to help make their bottom line successful as well.
And what you've done, I think, over the time that you've been there is you've been able to create or prove that there is an empirical, definable connection between design and bottom line. So it's not just nice to have.
Exactly. We've got two things, our workplace survey, where we surveyed successful companies domestically in Europe and in Asia. And we have what we call the workplace survey, which is a report of the findings of those surveys, and the last time we updated that was in 2016, and that was the second update. The other piece of that puzzle is something we call the WPI, which works hand in glove with that survey, but the WPI, Workplace Performance Index, is what WPI stands for. That is a kind of an empirical assessment by the users of each of. So if we're hired by a law firm, say, I do a lot of law firms. If we're hired by a law firm. We do the law WPI. It's a survey that goes to anybody at that law firm, that management of that law firm wants it to go. And we ask them, there's questions about four areas of workplace. Focus, which is like their heads down time at their desk or their office. Collaboration, which is the meeting areas and places where people come together. Learning and training. And lastly, socialization, the cafeterias, the meeting and greeting space. And if you look at all of those, we ask employees in those surveys to tell us what they need to do their job. It's not about where they are in the hierarchy of the company, but what do they need in their environment to do their job successfully. We get all that information. We tabulate it. It goes on a Tableau system. And we compare it to things that we found in the workplace survey. And how we got to proving that good design increases the bottom line is by looking at that workplace survey and the WPI. Top performing companies have, they're successful, but top performing companies are investing in good design. So as an architect or a designer, isn't me beating my breast saying, you got to do good design so I win some design awards. No, good design will increase your bottom line. It will help with hiring people. It will help with retaining people. And it will help with building the business. People get attracted to, a culture that is, that embraces design innovation and uses it to their advantage.
Because you have a lot of experience, not just in office space, such as legal offices. You do a huge amount of work in the retail space. And the sort of findings that you have in these other sectors, have you been able to cross-reference them and say, look, we've made massive leaps forward in retail by adding additional places for people to relax, to kind of hang out, so they're not just full-on retail experience? And have you found that there's all sorts of learnings that you've made from different divisions that you've been able to cross-fertilize into other divisions of your business?
We developed something called the Gensler Experience Index, and that's kind of a first-of-its-kind research program that proving that design is a differentiator between good experiences and great ones. So if we're delivering a great customer/employee experience by the design that we're doing, that we found that that is crucial to strong business performance in today's world. But it isn't enough. We also have to set the bar higher and broaden our metrics for success. But that, there's a whole long kind of program built around this Gensler Experience Index, but it's basically research that says creating a good experience for the user, using design to create a good experience for the user creates success for that space, whether it's retail, whether it's where people live, or whether it's where people work, shop, live, and work.
So all of these, this research that you've done, is innovation. It's innovation. It sets you apart from your competitors in what is a hugely competitive industry.
Yeah.
How do you maintain innovation in the workplace? We talked earlier about the studios that you have, but how difficult is it to maintain innovation in the workplace? How do you stop people from getting stale? How do you stop them from resting on their laurels?
Well, it's all, much of that, Matthew, is based on our research. We are looking for trends in all of those 29 practice areas. It's like color forecasting. We're looking for trends in law firms, for example, professional service firms. We're looking at trends in aviation and transportation. And the experts in those practice areas are asked and required and are passionate, actually, about uncovering what those trends are and giving that back to our clients. And that's our, again, that's an intellectual capital that we are using to gain new business. So, again, my own personal thing, I do a lot of law firms and I do a lot of banks. What is the cutting edge? What does the law firm of the future look like? What does the bank of the future look like? We're spending a lot of time doing research. The Gensler Research Institute is something that just kind of developed a name, but we publish we published two tranches of all of our research. It's like sets of white paper. You can buy You could buy the Gensler Research catalogs on Amazon now. I just went online the other day and sent it, forwarded it to a client and said, look, you can buy our journals on there. So they're there for public consumption.
And in these surveys, are there a number of elements that you found that really was the opposite to what you were expecting? So once you actually did the surveys and once you actually dug underneath really what people were thinking, were there one or two things that sprang out that really...
I think law firms, again, I keep drawing that analogy because it's something I know very well. I always say that law firms want to be the first to be second.
Yeah.
When it comes to they rely on precedent.
Yes.
And some of the things that surprised me is that we can talk about trends for the law firm of the future. We can show them other industries that are embracing some of those trends. Maybe it's not a law firm. Maybe it's a tech firm, or maybe it's a startup incubator space. But we are taking bits and bobs and pieces of those other industries and bringing those into that law firm environment, because those design innovations are something that will solve some of the goals and objectives that the law firm is looking for. So pretty soon you've got more lawyers, and the turnabout is, I don't go into a law firm and try to sell open plan, but I do talk about open plan. And it's not a one size fits all, but you'll find that there's a very open, accepting discussion of trends in workplace that gets lawyers out of their private office. Used to be two or three sizes of offices. We've got a lot of law firms that are going to single size, and that's the small size. And because they're finding that the increased density is like all of the rest of business. You got real estate costs and you got people costs. Those are the big expenses. And if you can fit more people into a smaller space and they can get their work done, we give them all the things that they need to get their work done: good air, good ergonomics, good light, and collaboration zones, they're going to be successful.
And do you think that there's a almost like sort of faint signals from the future to a certain extent, where back in the 80s, the early Silicon Valley companies, the Ataris, the Apples, the sort of culture that they were building, turn up to work in Bermuda shorts and sneakers. There's a pool table over there. There's a beanbag over there. Was that the beginning, do you think, of this understanding of the importance of the people and not the building?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think there's a romance. I think there's a romantic notion of how those companies grew and the culture around how those companies grew. And I think other more traditional companies are buying into that romance and buying into that culture of, being able to come in not in a three-piece suit, embracing the millennials and the future generations and what they're, because they're looking at that stuff and they want to be current with that kind of thinking. And those are the future leaders of all these more traditional. So people are being forced into kind of the evolution of that, based on, the wild success that the Apples and the Microsofts and some of those, Silicon Valley kind of companies had.
And talking of Google, for example, one of the things that they talk about, I was reading about them recently, was that they had this concept of moonshots. In other words, these are things that we're trying to do to go for the moon. And they also have roof shots. And a roof shot is, well, that's the moonshot up there, but the roof is right there. So as far as Gensler and your ability to steer the company into the future, what would you say your moonshots would be? What do you really think could really differentiate you forever more from all the competitors?
Well, we had this thing that one of our CEOs coined. It's called BHAGS, BHAGS. And these are our big, hairy, audacious goals. And we did this thing called Vision 2020. Like, where was the firm going to be in 2020? Where, we started doing these visions with different 5-year increments. And those big, hairy, audacious goals were kind of what we were saying our moonshots were. So it's like, think out of the box, think to the extreme, and, put that out there as a goal or something that we think we're going to move towards. And, you know, that's, and that was kind of the target that we were hitting and trying to hit.
And your personal prediction of how people will be working in, say, 10 years' time, with the advent of currencies being turned on their head, AI, you know, artificial intelligence changing the way that we think, the workplace moving from manual to automated, what sort of seismic changes do you think that we will see in the next decade?
I think a lot of people think that there'll be more people working at home or working, you know, working from home. And I think that will be the case, but I think the office will always have a place. I think people will always want to come to an office. They will want to collaborate. They will want to be with other people doing the same thing. I love my home and I designed it and I love to be there, but I love to come to the office. I love to be with that camaraderie. I also think artificial intelligence and virtual reality will affect, you know, we're using virtual reality to design spaces. We're putting goggles on people and letting them walk through. They can see exactly what their space is going to be in 3D, lit, in color. And, you know, we can walk them around a space, you know, whereas before we just put drawings up on the wall and, you know, kind of hope that we were outlining the way it was and they didn't walk in on move and dance. I don't even know what this is. I mean, yes. You never described this. They see exactly what these things are and we can animate them.
And do you think the office, based on your research, it sounds like the office is going to become much more than just a desk and a cubicle. It's much more about socialization, about relaxation. It's not 9 to 5. Right. It's more about how you become, it's an ecosystem, a miniature world.
I mean, just a simple analogy is, you know, in 1980, when I started designing, you had, you know, in interior spaces, you had the coffee pantry, the water cooler in the coffee pantry, and people kind of hung out around that at the beginning of the day. Now we have like Starbucks in every office. I mean, we have, you know, each client has their own version of Starbucks in the office. We find that there's a lot more emphasis put on the socialization. Again, back to the WPI, collaboration, making a space very comfortable and making it almost residential in areas. So people feel very comfortable and they've got a choice of areas where they want to work. So, you know, we've got companies that are free addressing. There's no assigned seat. They come in and they have a locker where they keep all of their personal belongings and then they can check out a place to work. They don't have to sit next to the same person every day that they may not like.
And I guess it's that attention to the long game as opposed to just trying to react or doing stuff for the here and now. That's the differentiator. That's the real difference.
And you know, the real challenge for us is, you know, you build these new ideas and they're implemented for our clients, but then we're on to what is the next big thing? What is the next big thing? How are we improving over that? I think we kind of did that with our firm. I mean, when Art and Drew opened the firm, it was about, you know, we were doing something that was innovative, but now it's we've embraced so many other things. We've embraced the business side of our own practice and how, you know, looking at our own practice and our clients, you know, our focus on our clients, but in a business way, how do we grow our business? How do we serve our clients and how do we grow our business and make ourselves more successful at the same time? And I will go back to Matthew, it's because we listen to our clients and we wanted to take them places that they never even thought they could go as well. We had clients with visions that hired us because they believed that we could do that.
Yes. And I think it is that, it's that vision. It's that, that's the key thing, isn't it? It's maintaining that fiery ball of design, innovation and vision that's the heart of the business. I would have thought it's just that, never letting that spark die.
Yeah, and it wasn't about how something looked necessarily. Yeah, we wanted to be attractive and, you know, pretty but it had to function really well. It had to, you know, it had to serve the purpose, but it had to do it in a way that was attractive and, you know, made people feel good, or maybe not to make them feel good if there, those were the goals and objectives of the space.
Is it your local dentist office or something?
Right,
designed
right.
To inflict pain the moment you step in the door.
Yes.
Yes, that's, I mean, it is incredible just to see just how everything changes, and to forgive the pun, but how you have been the architect of that change simply by listening to what people want. You've been able to create growth and innovation, and rather than stasis, which I guess is just, you know, the opposite, really.
One of the other things that I focused on in my career that was very important, when I came to Gensler, I was recruited by one of our CEOs, Diane Huskins, and she knew that I designed all these law firms and banks and other workplace things. But I said, Diane, I would really like to focus on product design. And I had this philosophy of, you know, there's so many things that as a designer in doing those spaces that I was doing, that they clients says, I want a chair or a table or a footstool that will do this. And I would go back to the library and do research. Couldn't find anything that was doing that. So, you know, I should be able to design that. And I should be able to design those products. We should capture that design. And we should have a manufacturer produce it. And we should get it out in the marketplace. And that became another necessity that, you know, we invented things by necessity because our clients were asking for it. But I think we were clever enough to figure out how we could create a profit center around it too. So while we don't put our name on products per se, there are a lot of products. We have a whole catalog full of products that are out that various manufacturers are manufacturing. And that we get paid a royalty on that. And those products are a source of, you know, they solve our clients' problems, but they're also contributing to our bottom line as well.
And would you say that one of the biggest problems in business, not just in your sector, but in business generally, and I guess you can spot this every day, is where companies are doing things that don't solve problems, where they don't listen to clients, where they're building stuff in a vacuum. Is it really as simple as that? Just listen to clients.
I do.
What is the problem? This is the solution.
I do think it is that simple. We are very hard on ourselves. We do a lot of self-critical analysis on, you know, if we make mistakes, we're humans. But I always say, you know, in my region with 750 people, we're going to make mistakes, and we've made some money errors on things, and we've gone overboard on things where we have to take responsibility for it. But what are the lessons learned on that? And can we use that experience to solve the next problem? Can we turn that, you know, those lemons into lemonade? And I think when people are not listening to what their clients are asking for, we're going to fail. You know, we may get a beautiful product, but if they're, you know, they walk in on day one and they start using it, and they're like, you know, I told you I wanted this, and yes, I told it this was a problem, and that we still have that problem here. It's beautiful, but we still have that problem. So we're very, before the product gets built, we do a lot of critiques. We do a lot of visioning sessions. We do a lot of exploration. We take our clients on tours to unrelate to other people's work, sure, to, you know, not just Gensler work, but other people's work, and say what is good and bad, and you know, how can we solve those problems yes, for you in a more creative way.
And I think that's it. I think that's it in any business, I think, is just that ability to stay pure to the message. You know, we solve your problems. Tell us your problems. Make sure we understand your problems. Make sure we're not substituting your problems for our problems.
Exactly.
And then deliver. So that's, and I guess that's the hardest culture to sort of maintain, is not to let your success run away with you, as it were. So you're sort of reining yourselves back.
I don't think that there's a Gensler look. I think, you know, we have been criticized in the past, you know, we're big and we're going to be less personal in our dealings with our clients, and you're going to get the open file door 32B and they pull out a solution and that's what you're going to get. You know, again, I do all these law firms. All the law firms that I've done are different looking. There isn't brand stamp on those, a Gensler brand stamp. There should be a brand stamp of the individual law firm. And I think we're doing that. I think we're practicing what we preach with that notion.
And the clients that you had 23 years ago, you personally, are they still your clients today?
Oh, thank you for asking. I had one client that I started working with in 1983. And the guy that gave me all that business with that firm finally retired, and then his replacement brought in like a new regime. And, you know, we understand, you know, hey, 25 years is a good run.
Yes.
to work with a major, you know, global company. I have a client that I started working with in 96, and I started by saying how much traveling I've been doing. I do their spaces globally. I'm the client relationship manager for that firm. I'm passionate about design, and I want to design, but I would be out of touch with running this region if I wasn't dealing with my own clients and my own, you know, our own projects and running this relationship. And it's very rewarding. These people are great. They're tough. They expect results. We're not just handed the business. We've got to perform. We're only as good as the most recent success or failure. And I do take the failures. They may ask for things that in the end they shouldn't have been asking for, and we'll give them to them. We try to work with them. But I take all those lessons learned over to the next project. So we are not repeating failures or mistakes again. And I think that client knows that's what they're paying Gensler for. That's what I bring to the table. And I am using I because that is my role with that, but I'm providing them a team. I'm providing them that constellation of stars.
But it sounds to me like each person in that team shares that same level of personal accountability, that same desire to be accountable. And I think that's critical. That's so different to
manage. I'm not going to bring somebody to that client into that client relationship that's not going to be passionate about wanting to see that client succeed. They have been, you know, loyal clients. Keeping the great clients that you've got now versus getting a new one, you know, that bird in the hand is much more valuable than the marketing money that I have to spend or that we have to spend in getting a new client on board.
But also from a client perspective, to actually meet and have a relationship with a firm like yours must be just a burden that's been removed, because
they don't have to start over on everything. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So
we speak the same language. After that one particular client, that the client I'm working with started in 96. So here we are in 2017. So that's, you know, that's 21 years of great relationships, you know, tough stories, tough scenarios, but you know, how did we, and they're a different firm than they were when I started working with them in 96.
So even today, with the advances of technology and remote working, it's still about trust. It's still about relationships and accountability.
Yes. Yes, very much so.
Well, that's fantastic. That's the constant in the ever-changing technology and design world. It's that is the constant that I think is that you can't fake. Do you agree? You can't pretend to be accountable or pretend to be passionate about what you do.
You're right. You can't fake it. Though clients are very smart. They will see through that shell game so quickly. You've got to be very genuine. You've got to be passionate. In this particular client, I was in New York yesterday, and they're looking at some things that are frankly very different than any of their other offices. I think each office I do for them has a culture that we're trying to exploit to a certain, it's within that firm, we're trying to exploit that local culture. And I was able to say from my position of seeing what the firm does as a whole, what their firm does as a whole, what the unique opportunity that they had. And I was presenting to a group of the design committee, which is a group of associates and partners. And I said, this is really exciting. You don't have to buy in. We don't have to go to an extreme with taking your operation into a less traditional approach. I'm not trying to make you in. We're not trying to make you into a tech firm. You're a law firm. But there's aspects of that tech firm which people will have buzz on the street, and they will want to come to work for you because you are embracing some of these ideas.
Yes. And again, my sort of final point really is that culture, that feeling of trust, accountability, passion, it's the blood that runs through the veins, and you can't build that overnight. You can't, if the firm doesn't have that, it's ice water that runs through their veins. So that's, I guess that's something that is that is the truly unique thing about Gensler?
One story I want to share, it's very quick. It is, again, about lawyers, law firms. But, you know, they want to hire people with experience. They don't want to be training me how to design their space. But you got to start somewhere. So that relationship that I grew with that first company that I worked with for 25 years, the guy came into our building. We had a small space on a floor of a building in Chicago. The guy came into the building. He was their head of real estate. He was looking for space. Yes, we designed all the spaces in that building, but he needed to use a phone, and I happened to be standing in the reception area. So this guy walks in. He's with one of the biggest, most prestigious law firms in the world.
Yes.
And tough law firm, you know, tough reputation out there,
yes,
of doing
yes.
good work. He used our phone and I started talking to him, and it turned out he didn't need to even interview architects. We developed a chemistry. My boss and I developed a chemistry with this guy, and we started doing, we did the huge New York headquarters, yes, then, you know, 50 floors of lawyers based on that one little conversation of a startup. But more importantly, I think I was listening to what they wanted. There was good chemistry, and we gave them a good team of folks that they enjoyed working with, that he was, yes, there every week. And you got to like the people you're spending your time,
exactly,
with. You can't just say, oh, they're the best firm, but oh, they're kind of jerks. And yeah, you know, I'm getting a really great product, but oh, it's, yeah, painful. I think what we've tried to do at Gensler is we've tried to make it a good experience as well as a collaborative experience, as well as an innovative, as I would say when I ran the London region and Europe region, innovative experience as well.
That's fantastic. Well, Ken, talking of innovation, I've got a slightly different pathway I'd like to take us now. So I've got my list of 10 questions that I've temporarily borrowed from James Lipton from Inside the Actor's Studio. So I'm going to hit you with 10 rapid-fire questions.
Okay.
And they're quite simple. And the first question is, Ken, what is your favorite word?
What is my favorite word? Empathy.
And what is your least favorite word?
Anxiety.
What are you most excited about right now?
I'm really excited to see how people that we hire at a very young, you know, formative age, right out of school, I'm very excited to see how their careers are building and what they're becoming.
Fantastic. And what turns you off right now?
What turns me off is closed-mind people that don't listen.
And talking of listening, what sound or noise do you love?
Music.
And what sound or noise do you hate?
Honking car horns.
Now, you can plead the fifth on this one if you like, but what is your favorite curse word?
Oh, gosh. Maybe I should plead the fifth on it. I use a few of them. The standard bad ones, you know. They get the job done quickly.
That's perfect. That delivers a message in four letters or less. So what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I would like to do something in the fashion industry or in acting, in performance.
And what profession would you not like to attempt?
I don't think that I'd be really, you know, I have empathy for the lawyers that I do, but I don't see myself as a lawyer. I love working with them and I love taking care of them, but I don't think that I could do that. And I love watching them work. I just don't think I could do it.
It is a particular skill. You're absolutely right. My final question, Ken, is if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
I would like to hear Stephen Sondheim music.
That's right.
That's not sending the clowns, but some of his other things.
Yeah, it's just that's fantastic. What else? Well, Ken, it's been such a pleasure having you. How do people find out more about Gensler, about what you're doing, about the innovation, about you?
Please go to Gensler.com, you know, to our internet. We've got these and visit, you know, Amazon, our, as I said, our research catalogs are there. And it's not dry. It doesn't, they're beautifully designed. They'll look pretty on your coffee table.
But I should think nothing less.
Really great material in all sorts of aspects of our design. But I think, you know, and if you live in, we've got those 44 offices. If you're living in a town where, you know, go to our internet and you'll see where those offices are. But call up and come in and see our office. We love to show our work. I mean, you don't have to have a product or a project in the offing, you know, but you might, you know, you might have a project, you know, tomorrow, but come in and see us. We love to show our work. We love to show off our work.
And, you know, the funny thing is I can really imagine someone taking you up on your offer and actually really being welcomed the moment they step in. So that is just a wonderful thought.
A real quick story is I live in Washington, D.C. We're right on K Street. And when we did our last expansion of our office at 2020 K, we went to the ground floor level and we have a storefront and it's all glass. And people walk by our office and they're like, what's going on? And it's beautiful. We've got client meeting areas, but we also have people working right in front of that glass. Yes. And we've got this coffee area too, with, you know, this beautiful espresso machine. So, yes. Bill and Hillary Clinton were walking by our office to go to the restaurant next door, which is a big establishment in DC, a power lunch establishment in DC. And they were looking at our windows, and our receptionist got up and walked out and said, Mr. and Ms. President, Mrs. Clinton, this was probably about 4 years ago. Can you come in? We'd love to give you a tour. They go, what are you doing in there? Come in, we're a design firm. Come in and we'll give you a tour. And they had to be next door for an appointment, but it was just really interesting that even our receptionist got up from her desk, went outside and greeted the Clintons and said,
because of the pride they have. And it's because it's the pride, but also the fact that she's not afraid that someone's going to say, what the hell are you doing? It's that lack of fear. It's that ability to innovate. It's a beautiful thing. That's brilliant. Well, Ken, thank you. It's been such a pleasure. And, you know, I really look forward to it.
Thank you for allowing me the opportunity.